Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to Germany reimposing border controls on migrants. The U.S. announcing it will be welcoming several thousand of the refugees. An author shares her thoughts on having everything just so.
With perfectionism, our whole identity gets tied up in our efforts, our appearance, our relationships.
And a new sound from a band's imagination and two top producers is right here on The Voice of America. European Union interior ministers are meeting in Brussels today to consider a European Commission two-year quota proposal to deal with the flood of migrants and refugees from the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story, and he joins me here in the studio. Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, this meeting follows Germany's surprise decision Sunday to reimpose border controls, a reversal of its previous open border approach. European Union analyst Ben Wellings of Australia's Monash University told me that Berlin's decision undermines the Schengen Agreement reached in 1985 and fully implemented 20 years ago that created a borderless area among 26 European countries.
We might expect a country to close its borders if there was an unprecedented migration from outside inwards. On the other hand, Germany's borders are regulated by something called the Schengen Treaty, and this is a treaty from 1995 that essentially provides the borderless Europe that we know. For the Germans to close their borders actually really imperils this fundamental treaty of European integration, and that's why this is, in one level, a surprise. And on the other hand, dealing with hundreds of thousands of migrants, we might expect governments to try and seek to control this flow of people in some way.
Apparently, a country within the EU and a signatory to the Schengen Treaty can do this on a temporary basis.
On a temporary basis, but it does go against the spirit of the Schengen Treaty and one of the kind of fundamental principles of European Union, which is the free movement of labour. But, of course, the intention of the designers of this treaty was for Europeans to move around within Europe, you know, without borders, inhibiting them and the movement of goods and services and capital as well. It was never really designed with such an unprecedented migration crisis in mind. And I think that, you know, there's always a tension in Europe between, you know, the kind of the European spirit, but then, of course, the fact that governments are in control of nation states, even in Europe, and probably becoming more so. So there's very much a kind of a conflict here, if you like, for the spirit animating European integration.
The Prime Minister of the Czech Republic said his country is boosting its police presence along the Austrian-Czech border. Hungarian authorities are about to fortify their southern frontier. Are we seeing a pushback to this crisis?
We certainly are. And it's interesting that the response is to build more fences and barriers. You know, to someone who grew up in the Cold War, this is quite evocative, the notion of barbed wire barriers between different nation states. And particularly those within Europe, where for 20 years, you know, the story has been about bringing down barriers. This is definitely a pushback. The other dimension to this, of course, is the religious or racial dimension, the extent to which Christian minorities be more welcome than Muslim refugees, as we see people like Viktor Orban making that case in Hungary.
Ben, EU officials Monday meet in Brussels to discuss a European Commission plan to allow in 160,000 asylum seekers over 2 years. Is this plan outdated even before it begins to be debated?
Well, I think the German decision will cast some debate on this. The so-called Visegrad countries, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia and Poland, are kind of welcoming this as an endorsement of their pushback. It will show the limits of the power of the European Commission vis-a-vis its member states. And the question is, you know, to what extent will other countries sign up, those countries without a tradition of receiving migrants, but rather, you know, sending them, like Poland, which they will sign up to resettling people caught up in the Syrian crisis. I wouldn't say that it's over before it started, but the European Commission and the interior ministers who are meeting are definitely going to have to be responding to events as they unfold hour by hour.
With about one half of the Syrian population currently displaced by the nearly five-year-old conflict, Wellings says he sees no near end to the migration crisis that's affecting Europe. He says the changes brought on by the so-called Arab Spring in the Middle East may result in a transformation of the region not seen since the end of the First World War.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what do you have to share?
Well, we've been talking about the refugee crisis through Europe and now how they've been using social media. And now the way they're using it is they're actually calling up the Coast Guard when they're on these boats and saying, oh, we need to be rescued. So they're actually using social media, using WhatsApp and some other smartphone applications to actually contact the Coast Guard. So I thought that was an interesting element to this
story. I wonder
story.
How the Coast Guard feels about that, you know?
I don't know. It's not clear. I think they're, you know, would rather rescue people alive than recover bodies. I think that's for sure. So anything that gets to that point, I think, is a good tool for sure. We've talked a lot about the Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India on the show. He's very social media savvy. And he's just announced that when he comes to the U.S. next month, he's going to be going to Facebook and doing a Q&A with CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh.
So a lot of people wondering what they're going to be talking about in this Q&A. Another example of how Modi's been so proactive in social media, reaching out to a huge audience in India. And I'm sure Facebook is thrilled that he's going to come and do this as well, because they've got, you know, hundreds of millions, you know, the billions of people in India, and then hundreds of millions of, if not billions of potential Facebook users. So I'm sure...
These dignitaries, politicians, more and more they're using the social media. If you're not using it, you're being left in the dust these days.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's done this, and he's done Twitter chats. He's had specific hashtags for chats that he's done. So he's been very good at it. He's been a model for other world leaders, perhaps. And then finally, big trending topics this weekend, big sports weekend in the U.S. this past weekend, start of the National Football League season. So a lot of people very excited about that. And then, of course, the U.S. Open, Serena Williams losing in the semifinals.
That was a surprise.
A shock for sure. A lot of people saying it's okay, she's still a great champion. A lot of positive comments on Twitter. Unfortunately, also some negative comments, people saying it's thinly veiled racism. People saying, oh, well, I'm glad a good person won, or I'm glad, you know, that Serena didn't win. She wins all the time. People saying that it might be some racist undertones to that. But she's still a champion and still had a great year.
And she's still very wealthy.
And still very wealthy. And so is Novak Djokovic, $3.8 million.
Whoa.
He won last night for winning the men's final over Roger Federer. So, and he said it's his best year ever as a father and a husband this year. So
that's nice.
Nice for him.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have discovered an incredibly massive and productive galaxy cluster located about 9.8 billion light years from Earth in the Ursa Major constellation. The galaxy cluster is named 1049 plus 56, and one of its most interesting qualities is its ability to produce new stars at an extraordinary rate. Galaxy clusters are parts of the universe where hundreds of galaxies group together and are bound to each other through gravity. The newly discovered galaxy cluster contains at least 27 galaxies and has a total mass equal to about 400 trillion suns. It's producing more than 860 stars per year. By comparison, our own Milky Way galaxy creates only one star each year. The astronomers were able to make the discovery with a combination of observatories. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
As huge numbers of people flee Syria and Iraq for Europe, the United States has announced it will be welcoming several thousand refugees. International Edition's Jim Stevenson asked VOA correspondent Michael Bowman how many refugees from this crisis will be coming to the U.S.
I believe that to date, the United States has taken in something on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 Syrian refugees. When you consider that millions of Syrians have been displaced, now not all of them are outside of Syria. There are many who are internally displaced. But nevertheless, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of Syrians who have fled their country. 1,000 to 2,000 is a drop in the bucket in terms of what the United States has taken in. And even with the Obama administration announcing that the United States will take in 10,000 additional Syrian refugees, those who advocate on behalf of refugees say that that is still a drop in the bucket. Uh-huh. It's a slightly larger drop in the bucket, but it really doesn't go far enough. Now we get into an interesting phase in terms of Congress, because today on national television, you had the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Representative Michael McCaul, saying, well, of course we want to help. And of course, the United States should be helping. But we can't simply allow a large population of people to come in without the proper screening. And he's very concerned that the Islamic State could try to put some of their people as infiltrators within the refugee population. And then, in effect, the United States would be importing Islamic radicals with nefarious intent, to say the least. The White House spokesman, Josh Earnest, at the briefing on Friday, said that there will be security protocols, and while time is of the essence in terms of responding to the refugee crisis, that there will be no corners cut.
I saw a figure online last week that said something on the order of the United States takes in about 70,000 refugees annually from various parts of the world. So the 10,000 figure would represent a pretty good portion of that. But a lot of human rights groups are calling for the United States to go well beyond that.
Indeed. I didn't hear this in any of the Sunday talking points. However, it's my understanding that the United States does provide a significant portion of the aid that is flowing into that region to combat the humanitarian crisis on the ground. Now, money does not equal sending money and relief supplies and blankets and medicines and food, that's not the same as taking in actual human beings. But I suspect that if one were to look at the totality of what the United States is doing, the United States is very much involved in the coalition that is battling the Islamic State. The United States is providing significant amounts of humanitarian relief. Where the United States does seem to be lagging is in the total number of refugees allowed. Whether this 10,000 is an initial adjustment to sort of see how it goes, and then maybe there will be other groups admitted. I don't know. No one has addressed that point yet. But what we do know is that over the next year to maybe 18 months, there will be a significant boost in the number of Syrians coming in. Does that address the Syrian refugee crisis? No, it doesn't. But the United States is boosting the total number.
That is VOA correspondent Michael Bowman here in our Washington studios. Coming up on International Edition, the downside of perfect, and the band Perry has something new for its fans. You know, being a perfectionist is not always a good thing. Sure, you get everything just right, exactly the way you want it, but it can cause trouble, too. Dr. Jane Bluestein has written a new book about it called The Perfection Deception, and she joins us now on the line. Welcome, Jane.
Hi.
That's a really cute title you've got there.
I wish I could take credit for that. That was I just write the books. They come up with the clever title.
Well, it's a good one. Hey, Alyssa, what is the downside to perfectionism?
Well, there are a lot of them. You know, what you're talking about is really looking, what we're looking for instead is really the pursuit of excellence, you know, really trying to do our best. The downside is with perfectionism, our whole identity gets tied up in our efforts, our appearance, our relationships. And then we try to control things that we don't always have a lot of control over. So if I can only be worthwhile in my mind, if I have this belief that I'm only lovable and safe and worthwhile if I'm not making mistakes, I'm either likely to not try something, I'm likely to give up if I don't succeed the first time, which, you know, quite frankly, most of us don't when we're doing something new, or if I'm with somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't have his shirt tucked in right or doesn't look the way I think she should look or whatever, it really can ruin your life because it takes all the joy out of pursuing new experiences, and it certainly is a real downer in a relationship.
Well, is perfectionism something you have or you don't? Can you stop being a perfectionist if you are already?
Well, you know, that's a great question because I can be really perfectionistic about certain things and really not care about others. So it's not like a switch that's on and off. And in fact, I've worked through an awful lot of my perfectionistic issues, but boy, writing this book brought a lot of them back up. So it's like a constant project. And I don't know that there's an off switch. You know, I started the fourth section with, which is about really healing and kind of not letting perfectionism run our lives, with my wish that I had a cure for it. What I have found in 2 years of interviewing hundreds of people who've wrestled with this issue is more that they have found ways to, you know, to manage the impact that it had, the negative impact, of course, that it has on their lives.
Well, how is the media contributing to the rise in perfectionism in people?
Well, the media is certainly, you know, would be very easy to blame for it all, but it's only one factor. And part of the, you know, the barrage of images that we're constantly getting about how we should look, how our home should look, what kind of car we're going to drive, and if we just do this, we'll be happy. If we can, you know, just go on this diet, or if we can just get this degree, or whatever. And there's always this promise that something, if we can just manage to get our own bodies into this size, shape, career, or whatever, that we'll be happy. There's always this payoff promised at the end. And so we look at people in ads, especially print ads, where, you know, they've all been airbrushed and photoshopped and stretched, where they don't even look like the people in them anymore. And we think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to look like. And how many people, men and women, are starving themselves or doing surgery or doing, you know, really harmful things to their bodies, thinking that they will be more lovable and acceptable if they just look like this person who doesn't even look like who they really are.
And that clever name of your book again?
The Perfection Deception.
Great. Thank you so much, Jane, for joining us today.
Thank you, Susie. It was great talking to you.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Grammy winners The Band Perry, siblings Kimberly, Reed, and Neil have been nominated for a CMA Award in the Vocal Group of the Year category. But their latest single, Live Forever, is more of a pop song than their traditional Newgrass Country. International Edition's David Byrd reports that the new sound came from the band's imagination and from working with top producers Red One and Diplo.
If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn, send me away with the words of a love song.
The band Perry, lead singer Kimberly and her brothers Reed and Neil, is known for its close harmonies, strong lyrics, and its bluegrass roots. Their breakout hit, If I Die Young, is a multi-platinum single and launched the group into country music stardom. But Kimberly Perry and her brothers have departed from that more traditional sound in their new single, Live Forever.
I was dreaming of war, saw that I wouldn't die. Was dreaming of shores that my ship would find.
That new sound is a result of the group's work with Lady Gaga's producer, Red One, who also produced Nicki Minaj's Starship. Kimberly Perry says that Red One's talent for teaming gigantic melodies with powerful lyrics to produce anthem-like songs was just what the band wanted.
that was one reason that we were really excited to work with him, because of course, coming from country music, you know, country's really all about the narrative. So we were interested in putting a really narrative lyric with a gigantic melody that made everybody who heard it really want to sing along with it. And so, you know, we brought our narration into the room, and Red One brought Big Melody, and Live Forever was born. We're gonna live.
The group also worked with producer Diplo, who has worked with Britney Spears, Shakira, Beyoncé, No Doubt, Justin Bieber, Usher, Snoop Dogg, and Chris Brown. Neil Perry, who plays mandolin in the band, says it was an exciting change for Diplo to record the acoustic-based band.
You know, it is interesting, too, to hear how a guy who wouldn't typically record organic instruments like mandolins,
banjo,
three-part family harmony, see how he would interpret that. And I think it made for some really unique sounds that will make this next album a step up from where Pioneer was. Yeah, we're gonna live.
The band Perry has not named their new album, and they have not announced its release date yet. But Kimberly Perry has said that the group was dreaming in color when they recorded the album, and the video for Live Forever is awash in bright yellow and other neon colors. Kimberly says that brightness and excitement is an indication of the flavor that fans can look for. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
We'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. And please listen to the show online by going to our website, voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Well over 4 million Syrians have fled the violence in their country. Most have found refuge in neighboring countries, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt. But as both the security forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad and violent extremist groups such as Daesh continue to target the civilian population, more and more people flee across the border. Syria's immediate neighbors already host such high numbers of refugees that the strain on their resources and communities is palpable. For example, Turkey now hosts over 2 million of the displaced, while, according to the government of Jordan, refugees now constitute over 20% of Jordan's population. So many of the Syrians have made the difficult decision to keep moving. Thousands of people, including entire multi-generational families, are now traveling through the Balkans and into Central Europe, hoping to reach a place where they can live productive and dignified lives until the killing ends in their home country. They are seeking safe haven in the many European countries, which are now in the process of deciding how many refugees they can host and are gathering their resources to help. The United States is also committed to maintaining a robust refugee admissions program and is particularly aware of the needs of the Syrian refugee population. The president has determined that the administration will accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees in the coming year. In the meantime, the United States is working in support of those countries that are already hosting large numbers of asylum seekers from Syria, particularly Syria's immediate neighbors. We are also sending aid to the millions of people who are in immediate need of humanitarian assistance inside Syria, including many who are internally displaced. To date, the United States has provided over $4.1 billion in humanitarian assistance since the start of the crisis. Most importantly, we are working through diplomatic channels towards a peaceful political resolution of Syria's conflict, because in the end, the vast majority of the refugees would someday like to return home. What is to happen eventually, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, is a political transition in Syria so that the Syrian people can have a home which is safe and secure.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.